Thank you. So, with thanks to Shari Shamayim, to their office for making this available and for making the copies, and to Jeff for all around helping out, as well as to the Law Society for approving the credit for the program this evening. Our topic is negotiating compromise, or sue or settle, promoting compromise. And what I'd like to do is first compare the systems of compromise in Ontario courts and in Jewish law, look at the logic behind each system second, and then look at some ramifications of the different approaches to compromise. There are quite a few papers that I consulted on this, both on Jewish law and beyond, and I can't credit all of them, but I do want to mention in particular a couple of papers by Samuel J. Levine, in particular one in the Journal of Catholic Legal Studies, which had very good information regarding a Jewish approach to compromise. Fordham Law, actually, Fordham's Law Journal had some very interesting ones as well. There's a lot of material that's been written about this. Some of the material is even reliable. So we begin by looking at systems of compromise in Ontario and in Jewish law. Ontario first. Historically, there was great debate about whether it's appropriate to pursue settlement at all. Whether we should say everyone is supposed to actually go to trial, and in an ideal society, everybody is able to act on their right to a trial, or whether there's merit to pursuing settlement. And here I'm going to draw on two articles which were written within the American system, but there are voices like them in the Canadian system as well. I just felt that the American articles really captured it nicely. One, against settlement, by a fellow by the name of Owen Fiss in the Yale Law Journal in 1984, and then a response, as you can see, from Andrew McThenia and Thomas Schaffer in the Yale Law Journal of the following year. So take a look at source number one, please. Fiss, as he says in his title, is against settlement. He does not believe that we should be promoting arbitration of various kinds, mediation of various kinds. In source number one, he writes, "The advocates of ADR, alternative dispute resolution, are led to support such measures and to exalt the idea of settlement more generally because they view adjudication as a process to resolve disputes. They act as though courts arose to resolve quarrels between neighbors who had reached an impasse and turned to a stranger for help. Courts are seen as an institutionalization of the stranger, and adjudication is viewed as the process by which the stranger exercises power. I do not believe," he says, "that settlement as a generic practice is preferable to judgment or should be institutionalized on a wholesale and indiscriminate basis. It should be treated instead as a highly problematic technique for streamlining dockets." He says, the goal of settlement is utilitarian. It is, we have too many cases, we do not have enough courts and enough judges to possibly manage all of them. Let's streamline the docket by getting people to solve their problems in other ways. That's his first complaint, is that it's just a means of streamlining things and it's not particularly good at it. He says, settlement is for me the civil analog of plea bargaining. Consent is often coerced. The bargain may be struck by someone without authority. The absence of a trial and judgment renders subsequent judicial involvement troublesome, meaning that depending on how they came to the conclusion that they came to, if there's a challenge to it later on or someone refuses to comply and they have to go to court, the judge may often have no clue as to how they reached this conclusion, why they reached this conclusion, and have to reconstruct the entire process just to understand why what's there is there. And although dockets are trimmed, justice may not be done. Like plea bargaining, settlement is a capitulation to the conditions of mass society and should be neither encouraged nor praised. How many different claims do you see here? How many different charges against settlement do you see? What has him exercised? Well, he's upset that he claims that it's often coerced, and what he means by that, he writes elsewhere in his article, is the concern that there are unjust financial incentives to settle sometimes, and you don't have a judge to balance that out. The conclusion is reached not by a judge, but by some person who has been picked as a mediator, negotiator, or arbitrator. It's not necessarily with the consent of the represented parties, and that's something he discusses at length in further pieces. You can see I brought you number 2 and number 3, but we're not going to read them aloud in the interests of time. But he's worried about the fact that, let's say you have a union, and the union has people who are negotiating on behalf of the union. You don't necessarily have everybody within the union. Not all of them are necessarily given the opportunity to weigh in the process in the same way that they would be able to in the event that there was that there was actually a proper hearing and a proper system. His argument is that there are imbalances of power within the court. His argument is that it's not a judicial process. The rules are not clear for how it's going to be done. He's very upset about the idea of settlement, and it comes through beginning of the article to the end. In 1985, McPhenia and Schaffer write their response, and they contend that he's wrong not only in terms of the specific points that bother him, but also in terms of his overall point about justice. If you take a look at source number 4, he says, many advocates of ADR, alternative dispute resolution, make efficiency-based claims. And a plea for ending the so-called litigation explosion and for returning to law and order runs through the rules of procedure branch of the ADR literature. But the movement, if it is even appropriate to call it a single movement, is too varied for Fiss's description. It's not only about simplifying things. Fiss's description of traditional dispute resolution, I added in the word settlement, that's what he means, is a story of two neighbors, quote, in a state of nature, who each claim a single piece of property, and who, when they cannot agree, turn to, quote, a stranger to resolve their dispute. The soundest and deepest part of the ADR movement does not rest on Fiss's two neighbors model. It rests on values of religion, community, and workplace that are more vigorous than Fiss thinks. In many, in fact most, of the cultural traditions that argue for ADR, settlement is neither an avoidance mechanism nor a truce. Settlement is a process of reconciliation in which the anger of broken relationships is to be confronted rather than avoided, and in which healing demands not a truce, but confrontation. Instead of trivializing the remedial process, settlement exalts that process. Instead of reducing the social function to one of resolving private disputes, settlement calls on substantive community values. What's their response to Fiss in terms of what drives settlement? What are they getting at here? Oh, this is a room of smart people. Sorry?
He's saying that the negotiation of the settlement isn't just, you know, people banging heads together and twisting each other's arms. There's reconciliation and consideration of their interests.
There's reconciliation of their interests and?
They're making their minds up for themselves.
But it's also not.
It's reconciliation,
meaning this is not a practical, or more better stated, pragmatic solution. But this is actually something that, thank you, is better for society at large.
But it may not be better for the parties.
May not be better for the parties, meaning?
If one party is right and the other is wrong, and we have to find a mediation or arbitration that decides 100% one favor and 0% the other. I represent a client. We have a case that's right. We will not get 100% of the result if we go to mediation or arbitration.
Right. So if one party is right and the other party is wrong, and we're talking 100-0 here, then that's not the result you're getting when you arbitrate. Now, we're going to come back to that point later. But what will they respond to that concern? How will they justify the ADR system? Yes?
Well,
Correct. Their argument is that society as a whole, I'm going to go beyond what Mrs. Witte said about healing the relationship. What they're really contending is everybody wins when there is shalom, when there's peace. When everybody's going to get along afterwards, and that's a big assumption that just because we made a settlement, therefore they're all going to get along. But that's essentially what they're charging. They're saying that there will be peace as a result of this settlement, and because of that, even if you don't get as much money as you would have gotten by going to trial, it's worthwhile. Now, in preparing this, I spoke to several lawyers who deal in litigation, and the point was made by more than one that the person who is going to go to trial, whether plaintiff or defendant, is going to have great costs involved in going to trial, which they could avoid by accepting a settlement offer. So add into the complexity of the calculation the money they've saved by settling. It could be that if they went to trial, they would get 100%. But once you knock off the HST, so to speak, they're not getting 100% anyway. It could be that they'll do better this way than they would have by going to trial. You say no because?
First of all, if you're in the commercial, you're very naive if you're in the commercial setting.
Yeah.
I suggest that that's going to happen. And there's no reason why I want the competitor to continue in business by putting into bankruptcy and winning this lawsuit, of which I have the right to do.
Maybe.
Well, there are circumstances that justify that.
Yes.
There's circumstances that don't justify that.
Right.
I don't see how you can be black and white either way.
Correct. And you can't be black and white either way. And I'm going to come back to that point also.
But in a way, like, isn't this really like some ex post facto justification for ADR? I mean, we didn't come up as a society with ADR because there were too few dockets and nothing for judges to do. Right? We came up with it because we were overwhelmed and litigation was out of control. So, I mean, to me, you know, even if this is some sort of restorative feel-good justice where everybody kind of gets along at the end of the day, which I'm not sure is really true, you know, I think, you know, Tahina and Schaefer are kind of like rewriting history a bit, right? Like, they're coming up with this notion that, like, this is a wonderful thing and it's based in community values and, you know, we should really encourage it, but is that really how we got here? I don't think so.
Right. That's a very good question. Are they drinking their own Kool-Aid? Essentially is the question. When McDinney and Schaefer write that this is about peace within society, how seriously are we meant to take this? Given that, realistically, the genesis of ADR and the genesis of settlement in North American courts really starts when society has a problem. It doesn't start at a time when, as you said, the dockets are empty. It starts when there's a need to streamline things. And I'm going to come back to that and make that point stronger. Jeff?
What about this idea of peace within society or peace among neighbors? How does that apply when it's a company or an individual against an insurance company or a bank?
Right, that goes back to the point of the commercial setting. Where it's a commercial setting, we're not interested in a relationship with each other, potentially the issue of rivals, or if it's a corporate setting where there are no people actually face-to-face.
But all of us is not a relationship.
I mean, right.
There is a relationship period with a bank or an insurance company,
right,
but there's no real relationship.
Right. All true. I'm going to take one more comment, but then I'm going to have to go further with this because there's a lot more to see. Go ahead, and then Morris, and then we'll go on.
It also is a bit of an ivory tower view because it sort of disregards the fact that it sort of contemplates, both of them contemplate that we're all always in a state of conflict, because what really happens is, like, people have a disagreement, you know, probably 9 times out of 10, they resolve them. They actually do settle before it gets to the litigation stage, probably more than 9, probably 99 out of 100, 999 out of 1,000, who knows? But the vast majority of conflicts get settled before litigation.
Right.
So the reality of ADR and mediation and so on is that it tries to coax you back onto the settlement track. Neither of them are saying that they settle your differences before you issue a statement of claim is a bad thing, but they sort of forget about that whole thing, both of them.
In other words, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that people do this even without the ADR track. The ADR track is just a goad and an opportunity.
That's a well down the road.
Right.
Like, conflicts are resolved every day without resorting to lawyers and courts. And it's I mean, who's going to argue that's a bad thing?
Right. Okay. Morris.
I was going to say that. There are very few disputes that are so black and white that somebody's so certain going to court that they're going to win.
Right.
And I think certain what ADR or mediation provides is certainty, knowing what you're accepting, what you accept, you know, is the certainty of the results, rather
right.
than leaving it to chance. I mean, that's one of the things that most litigation lawyers find is that you never know what's going to happen when you have to work on it. So I just lose that, you know.
So the suggestion is that going to mediation may aid by providing some sense of control, really, of what's going on. But I would challenge that. Only I'm challenging it without leaving you the opportunity to respond, because we have to go further. But I wonder if that's true in all forms of this. Like, when you have arbitration, you know, and you agree in advance to binding arbitration, you have less control than if it's done by negotiation between the parties. But there's a lot more to say, and I want to go further with it, so I'm gonna do that, only in the interest of time. When you get to practice, Ontario's rules of civil procedure are in favor of negotiated settlements. Going back to the 1970s, there was a practice of a pre-trial meeting with the judge, or something that I found called designated hitter mediation, where it would be a separate judge who would actually sit down with the parties beforehand to attempt to solve or simplify the issue. And you can see in source number 5, Rule 50 from the Rules of Civil Procedure governs this pre-trial. It's 50.01 says the purpose of this rule is to provide an opportunity for any or all of the issues in a proceeding to be settled without a hearing, and with respect to any issues that are not settled, to obtain from the court orders or directions to assist in the just, most expeditious, and least expensive disposition of the proceeding, including orders or directions to ensure that any hearing proceeds in an orderly and efficient manner. Okay, that's step one. Step two, if you flip the page, is Rule 24.1 in the Rules of Civil Procedure. Beginning in 1999 as an experiment, and then enshrined in law starting in 2002, Ontario has mandatory mediation for civil suits other than for family law cases. Family law has its own rules. But parties are able to select from a list of mediators, and or one is going to be appointed for them in the event that they don't succeed in selecting a mediator. And as you see in source number 6, 24.1.01, this rule provides for mandatory mediation in specified actions in order to reduce cost and delay in litigation and facilitate the early and fair resolution of disputes. I didn't see anything in that line that said, and in order to make sure people will get along. Right, it's very clear in saying exactly what the goals are and what we are trying to accomplish. It is to reduce cost and delay and facilitate the early and fair resolution of disputes. In addition to these two stages that are involved in civil suits, the pretrial meeting, as well as the mandatory mediation, the lawyer is expected to act as a filter. And that's a little tricky. Because on the one hand, source number 7 speaks of, this is now the Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 5.1-1 and 5.1-2, speaks of the responsibility of the lawyer to be a zealous advocate on behalf of the client. So I am responsible, if I were a lawyer, would be responsible to promote the interests of my client, and if I felt that was litigation, then I would be responsible to pursue that. And that's the beginning of source number 7. When acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall represent the client resolutely and honorably within the limits of the law while treating the tribunal with candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. But then you look at the second half of that same source, 5.1-2. When acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall not, A, abuse the process of the tribunal by instituting or prosecuting proceedings which, although legal in themselves, are clearly motivated by malice on the part of the client and are brought solely for the purpose of injuring the other party. Now, I'm not sure, and all of you can tell me, but we're not going to go this route right now. I'm not sure how this works when you tell me that a lawyer is not allowed to represent a client in the interests of injuring another party, but if you have, like the commercial dispute mentioned earlier, I want to drive him out of business because, and now I have the opportunity because of something that he did, does this mean I can't do that? I can't litigate to that extent? I suspect, as you said before, it's not black and white. If he did something, and that left him vulnerable to being driven out of business, that's the way business works. So I'm not speaking to that question. What I bring this here for is to note that the lawyer is actually being charged with acting as a filter for the system to avoid anything dishonorable or dishonest, and to avoid actions that are motivated by malice or a desire to injure the other party. By the way, rules of civil procedure also note that the court can throw out such a suit as well, but the lawyer is being asked here not to take on such litigation. And then the one that's most relevant for us, source number 8, Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 3.2-4. A lawyer shall advise and encourage the client to compromise or settle a dispute whenever it is possible to do so on a reasonable basis, and shall discourage the client from commencing or continuing useless legal proceedings. The underlinings are my own. How would you define reasonable basis? What's a reasonable basis? What's our definition of reasonable?
Reasonable chance of success.
Reasonable chance of success. What does that mean? I mean, we're talking about settling here. So they're supposed to encourage the client to compromise or settle whenever it is possible to do so on a reasonable basis. It's not about whether you're going to win. Yeah. Proportionality, meaning proportion between his expenses and what he's going to get out of it. Okay, could be. Cost benefit, cost and reward. What else? What other possible standards are there for defining reasonable? Yeah.
Risk assessment.
What could he lose by going to trial?
Well, the likelihood of winning, the likelihood of losing.
Right. That's another way to look at it. One person who I consulted on this, who is a professional mediator, suggested that it's simply best interest of the client. That's what's considered reasonable. If you believe that this is in your client's best interest, then settle. That's the standard that he went with. Now, best interest is complicated, because best interest doesn't just mean financial interest. Best interest means professional interest. It means stress. It means time. In the event that he is waiting for this to conclude because he needs whatever money he's going to get out of it, it could be get more if he litigates, but he's going to have to wait 3 years. Better for him to settle now and be able to get something out of it, even if it's less than he would have gotten 3 years from now. Sorry? I'm only suggesting a hypothetical. We don't have an actual person involved, so you know, this isn't legal advice since he doesn't exist. But yes, in my opinion, there could be such a situation in which it will be better for him to settle and get his money now, as opposed to litigating and getting something in 3 years from now. Had someone been in a position in which 3 years ago he was going to get $100,000 Canadian, but instead he litigated it and he got instead $110,000 or $120,000 Canadian now, I think he'd be asking himself whether it was worth losing the exchange rate. His dollar is now worth 30% less. All sorts of factors can come into play. I don't mean to give any legal advice for any of them. Yes.
I mean, I think what's potentially problematic about the rule is the directive to the lawyer to encourage the client to settle in these cases, right?
Yes.
It's one thing to say, you know, discuss it, bring it to the client's attention, discuss how it's reasonable and what could be gained from it. It's another to say you should be encouraging the client to do this, which basically tells the client, I think this is a better option for you. You should do this instead of going to court. That is my professional advice to you, when maybe it's not better. Maybe maybe it's just reasonable, and you know, the rule is telling the lawyer to tell the client that, in, you know, your professional opinion, it is the better thing to do.
Right, and that's something that I'm really stuck on. The question that's being asked is, you're supposed to encourage it where it's reasonable. The word reasonable, as we usually use it, is sort of a settling word in and of itself. Not what we call lechatchila, what you'd want to do. It's sort of, okay, this is reasonable. Something I can get behind if you need to. But you're telling me I'm supposed to encourage him to do this. I would think the standard for that which I'm going to encourage would be higher than reasonable. It would be, this is good for him. This is the best option for him. So, yes, I hear the problem. I don't have a real answer for it. Yes, and then...
The law society rule, what they're trying to do is protect the client from the lawyer, in the sense that, in terms of a personal injury claim, the lawyer makes a quick session, but a third of $100,000 in a quick settlement is good for him, not necessarily good for the client. So don't encourage him to settle just because you wanted to. So you can make the quick, you know,
interesting.
You have to only settle if it's reasonable for him.
So that's a very interesting approach. That's the opposite of the way that I would have read it, although definitely can see how it fits into the wording. The suggestion is that what you're actually saying is that the word reasonable is a limitation on the lawyer. You shall encourage only when it is reasonable for the client to do so. It's a good read. It's an interesting read. I don't know. Yes?
I think the whole notion of reasonable settlement is an oddity in itself, which is why it has to be written in your room. The fact is that when people come to any legal representative, they're coming not to settle. They've already tried it. They're exhausted from it. In fact, they come to you with the 11th hour, and they spend time and money on it. That's why they come to you. And now you're going to tell them to settle? That's what's the oddity in all of this. And that's why that's
right.
And here it's also fairly close to the same thing. The fact is that that's actually what we do need to try to do, especially if you do have a person, not a commercial entity.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you must write it. And it's very difficult for you as a legal representative to get them to see that that is one of the goals.
Interesting.
That's showing them this is helpful. Showing them this is helpful. And that's what I think is very important for you.
Okay, I'm not challenging that it's written. I was looking for explanation of what it means. But definitely I hear you that the people who come to the lawyer, generally speaking, certainly if they're individuals, not experienced corporations, think that by going to the lawyer, that means they're going to court and need to have it explained to them that it's not so. The other piece of this that requires explanation is the useless legal proceedings. How do you define useless legal proceedings? It can't be if you're going to lose. There has to be a better definition than that. Nonetheless, that's the definition that I've been given by lawyers on this phrase, useless legal proceedings, that it means if the case is without merit, if it's a delay tactic which doesn't have merit in its own right, those are the kinds of explanations that I've heard for useless legal proceedings.
You're a useless lawyer if you can't find merit in anything.
Sometimes come to you with ridiculous things.
Yes.
Come to you with things that aren't justiciable, and you have to tell them.
Right. Right. Okay, so we've now talked for about 25 minutes, and we haven't yet gotten to the Jewish part of all of this. So now we're going to shift gears into the perspective of Jewish tradition on this, and for that we have to look at a decent-sized passage from the Talmud source number 9, which has the same philosophical debate as to whether we're supposed to go with compromise or not, but from a slightly different perspective, because, as we've noted in other sessions, the position of lawyer doesn't exist in a basic Jewish court. There is an option for a toein, as it's called in court today, or an oreich din. The title oreich din, arranger of the law or arranger of the case, goes back to Talmudic times, but fundamentally a Jewish court doesn't need lawyers, and therefore, when we talk about whether you should go for a settlement or not, we're actually speaking to the judge and asking whether the judges on the rabbinical court, a standard basic rabbinical court, has three judges, although we'll talk about that later. But the idea is whether the judge should push the idea of compromise. One note on the translation that I gave here. There are two different words that are used Talmudically for compromise. One is called bitsua, and the other one that people are more familiar with is pshara. They mean different things. Bitsua means to split. It suggests more of an arbitration in which an outside person is going to say, you get this and you get this. Pshara, as we'll see later, comes from the word poshrin, which means lukewarm water. It's not hot, it's not cold. And that suggests more of a mediated, negotiated agreement in which the sides come to the middle. So take a look at source number 9, please, in which we will see three different views. First view, Rabbi Eliezer ben Osher of Yossi Aglili Omer, Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi of Galil, said, and we're talking about someone who lived in the first century common era. He said, Asur livtsala. He says, it is prohibited for you to split. I didn't use the word compromise, I translate bitsua as splitting. You're not allowed to impose a split on the litigants. And one who does that is a sinner. And then there's a piece where he quotes you various verses on the word bitsi'ah as sin. I skipped it because it didn't relate directly to the law discussed here. Ela yikov hadin es ahar. He says the law has to split the mountain. That's the phrase. The law has to split, or literally puncture, I suppose, would be a better word, or pierce, as I wrote here. Let the law pierce the mountain. Ki amishpat le'elokim hu, because justice is for God. You don't mess with God's justice. That's what he says. And he talks about how when the Jews were led by Moshe and Aaron, Moses and Aaron, on their way from Egypt into the land of Israel, Moshe's style was Yikov Adin Esahar, let justice pierce the mountain, whereas Aaron, the high priest, is the one who's known for making peace. We could spend the next hour talking just about that, but we're not going to in the interests of time. There's a lot to be said about the approaches of Moses, the approach of Aaron, and so on, but the point is, view number one says you are not allowed to impose any sort of split on the litigants. View number two, Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha Omer, mitzvah livtsawa. Rabbi Yoshua, son of Karcha, says it is a mitzvah to pursue splitting. Shenemar, because the verse says, Emes umishpat shalom shiftu b'sha'arechem. This is a verse from the prophet Zechariah. You should judge truth and justice of peace in your gates. The gate is traditionally the location of the city's court. So you should judge truth and mishpat shalom, justice of peace. So the Talmud asks, Vala b'makom sheyesh mishpat ein shalom b'makom sheyesh mishpat. Where there is justice, there is no peace. This is the opposite of the rallies, right? Where there is justice, there is no peace, and where there is peace, there is no justice. And what they mean to say is that if you apply the letter of the law, someone's going to be unhappy. Someone is going to be upset. And therefore, there won't be peace. And if you're going to make peace between them, you're not going to follow the letter of the law. How can that be? And so he says, Zebitsua. That's a reference to splitting. When you split, you have peace, but there's also an element of law that is involved that guides how you make peace. And then he quotes a second verse, and I'm going through the two verses in particular for reasons that will become clear later. The second verse is regarding David HaMelech, King David. The verse says, "Vayi David osem mishpat utzdakah," that King David performed justice and tzedakah. The word tzedakah is an interesting word in Hebrew. It has connections to philanthropy that we think of and helping other people. It also, though, has its roots in the word tzedek, which is righteousness. But the idea here is that it is more benign. It's not simply the righteous law, but there is a benign element. And so the Talmud asks, if there's justice, then there is no tzedakah. If there's tzedakah, there is no justice. So their conclusion is, no, this is splitting. When you split it, you have an element of justice, but you also have a more gentle side to it. That is tzedakah. And so Rabbi Yoshua, son of Karcha, says, the mitzvah is for you to pursue splitting it. And then there is a third view. And the third view is the view of Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh, Rabbi Shimon son of Menasseh. And his view is, it depends. When the litigants, yeah, you knew that. There's always going to be someone who says it depends in a Jewish debate. But his answer is, and I'm summarizing it, but you can see the text in front of you. When the litigants come to you, then you can tell them, go split. However, once you've heard their sides and you know where the verdict leans, at that point you're not allowed to do it anymore, because then you're warping the judgment that you know to be true. You know that this one should get this and that one should get that, and you are actively changing that? Not allowed. That's the third view. The ideological debate involved can be explained as justice versus perversion of justice. That's one way to look at it. With the first view saying it's a perversion of justice, let justice pierce the mountain. And the second view saying, no, it's better for us to do this. Peace is more important. Even if it perverts the justice, doesn't matter. Peace is more important. And then the third view saying, really, I'm on the side of justice. But it's not really an issue until they've spoken their part. Until they speak their part, you can resolve their disputes. That's one way to look at this. Another way to look at it, though, which we're going to come back to, is it depends on how you define justice. What does justice itself mean? Do you take a narrow version of it or a broader version of it? And we're going to come back to that and what I mean by that. In practice in Jewish law, take a look at source number 10. Maimonides codifies it in 12th century Egypt. He writes, Mitzvah lomar lebalei dinim batchila bedin atem rotzim o bipshara. It is a mitzvah to say to the litigants first, do you want law or do you want pshara, balancing? Im ratzu bipshara osim b'neim pshara. If they want balancing, go for it, do that. If a court does this all the time, that's praiseworthy. Better for them to seek to balance the sides. When is this true? Kodem gemardin, until you get to the verdict. Meaning, at any point within this suit, at any point within this trial, they can say, we want to go with a compromise, we'd like to negotiate something, and the court can say, okay, we're going to take that view, we're going to go with the negotiation. Even though they've heard the positions of the litigants and they know which way the law leans, mitzvah limtzoa, it's still a mitzvah for them to do this balancing. But once the verdict is in, and the judge has said, you're innocent, you're guilty, you owe the money, you're receiving this sum, whatever it is, then you can't do this anymore. Let justice pierce the mountain. But the point again is, Maimonides is saying, and the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, Choshen Mishpat Yud Beis Beis, uses the same language, saying that the court is supposed to pursue this type of compromise. Now, I mentioned before that there are two different kinds of compromise, right? There are many kinds, but they fit into two categories. There's arbitration. We're going to go to an outside authority, and the outside authority is going to hear the sides and come up with a verdict. And then there's mediation or negotiation, in which the two sides are going to hash it out together with the help of an intermediary, but they're going to come to some kind of an agreement that they're both going to weigh in on before it is set. So very interestingly, an article by a lawyer by the name of Yitzhak Kazdan, he makes this point. Take a look at source number 11 from the same page of the Talmud. Look at this interesting debate. Bitsua b'shlosha divrei Rabbi Meir. V'chachamim omrim pshara b'yachid. Rabbi Meir says that splitting is done with three judges. The sages say no. Even one judge is sufficient for doing this balancing between the sides. They're using the words for compromise interchangeably. Splitting and balancing, bitsua and pshara, they're using them interchangeably. But the debate is three judges or one judge. That's an important point that we're going to come back to. But they continue to say, demar savar, why does one say three judges and one say one judge? Because one of them says, one view is, makshinam pshara ladin, that we view compromise as a form of justice. And therefore, just as justice in a court requires three judges, you need three judges to do the compromise also. Whereas the other view says, lo makshinam pshara ladin, we don't link the two. It's a completely separate thing. So a rabbinical court needs three judges. But if you're just negotiating a compromise, one judge is sufficient, just that one arbitrator. It's not a legal proceeding, is really the debate here. Is this a legal proceeding or not? You follow? Everyone clear on that? That's the idea. But then he continues. Rav Ashi, who was a sage from the 3rd century Common Era, says the following. He says, we see from here that pshara, this balancing, eina tzricha kinyan, does not require an act of kinyan. An act of kinyan means an act that you perform that symbolizes acceptance of an agreement. That's what kinyan is. So, a negotiation like this doesn't require an act of kinyan, he says. Why? Because if you needed that, then why would anybody require three judges? Meaning, if I go to a court with three judges, their opinion is law, no matter whether I agree to it or not. So if you consider compromise a legal proceeding, then it doesn't matter whether you agreed to it or not. You shouldn't need to perform an act of kinyan in order to be bound by what they say. What they say is the law, beginning, middle, and end. From the fact that someone is going, what he says is, if you say you need three judges, then you don't need a kinyan. If you believe you need a kinyan, then one judge is sufficient, and it's not really a legal proceeding at all. That's the argument that he brings. So on that point, there's another debate which I didn't bring here. I thought that I had. Which also... I see why I didn't. I know why. Because it's a latter day debate. It's Tosfos commenting on this source number 11. It's a commentary from the 12th century that has a debate. According to the view that you do require an act of kinyan, is it before you do this compromise? Or is it only once the compromise has been agreed to? And based on that, Ira Yitzhak Kazdan in source number 12 argues that they're actually debating about what kind of mediation you're doing. If you have to do your kinyan before the negotiations, then it's binding arbitration. You made your kinyan saying, I'm going to do whatever they tell me to do. Whereas, if you're going to say that the kinyan happens at the end, once you've already heard the decision, then it's really negotiation mediation. In the sense that you're agreeing to something you know. It's not a black box. So I thought that was an interesting point. But the upshot of what we've said so far is, within general secular society, there's hot debate about the justice involved when engaging in compromise, but fundamentally it is enshrined in our court system, and lawyers are told that they're supposed to encourage reasonable settlement. Within Jewish law, we are told that there is a three-way debate about whether this is a good thing to do or not. And in practice, we rule that yes, you are supposed to, the judge is supposed to try to pursue compromise with them all the way up until the end. Unclear, there's a debate as to whether we're talking about some kind of negotiated agreement or whether we're talking about something that is imposed by an arbitrator. And there's a debate as to whether this is a form of justice, such that you need three judges and no kinyan, or whether this is really just a standalone proceeding. It's not part of a legal proceeding, and therefore you can have one judge involved, and therefore you need an act of kinyan that's going to bind them to accept the conclusions. Clear so far? That's the 5-second summary? Okay. Let's move further. So that's a really good question. Can the judge who's involved in this, in these negotiations, be the judge who hears the case? So, interestingly, that debate comes up also in secular law. But within Jewish law, the answer is yes. Same judge is entitled to do that, and here we're actually instructing that judge who's hearing the case to promote that settlement. So, the resolution of the philosophical debates differs between the societies in interesting ways. In Ontario, the conclusion is very pragmatic. I brought you an example in source number 13 in a decision in which they quoted an earlier case, the Sparling case, to say the courts consistently favor the settlements of lawsuits in general. This is the middle of source 13. To put it in another way, there is an overriding public interest in favor of settlement. This policy promotes the interests of litigants generally by saving them the expense of trial of disputed issues, and it reduces the strain upon an already overburdened provincial court system. It is the pragmatic solution. We are going with settlement because without it, people spend a lot more money and the courts are held up. And in fact, if you go to the Attorney General of Ontario, if you go to the website, they have a full article, which I gave you the link for at the end of Source 13, that lays out the costs and says, oh, of course you want to mediate. You don't want to go through all of these costs and go for mediation.
Why don't we encourage the police to shoot the crook?
Oh boy, am I not going there. So within Judaism, we find that in practice there are multiple motivations for promoting compromise. One is the drive for peace within society. We already saw the reference to Mishpat Shalom, justice of peace, but take a look at source number 14. Rabbi Yehoshua Boaz is also known as the Shilte Giborim. He wrote the commentary Shilte Giborim to the Rif. He wrote it, as you see, in 16th century Italy. The truth is he's quoting here Riaz. Riaz is often mistranslated as the Or Zarua, who is much earlier, but that's not who he's quoting. But he's quoting somebody basically of his era, 15th, 16th century Italy, with the following statement. He says, Achlo nigmar adin, until the verdict is concluded, like we saw in Maimonides, Rashai hadayim lahatil pshara beinayim, the judge is allowed to impose balancing among the parties. Avo bishayada heichan adin nota, even though he has a good idea in his own mind of who's right. But once the verdict is in and he has said, you're guilty, you're innocent, he's not allowed to create a compromise. But then he goes on. He says that's talking about an arbitrator type of a role, where the judge is going to impose it on the litigants. Then he's not allowed to after he knows the verdict, after he's stated the verdict. But if the judge says to them, you know, here's my proposal for what you could do. And the judges persuade them. Until they agree and one will forgive the other. Or one says, yeah, I'll give you what it is, whatever the item is. It is appropriate to do this even after the verdict. As long as there is no coercion involved. Just attempts to persuade. Vizohi mitzvah gedola. This is the key line for what we're talking about right now. He says this is a great mitzvah. Vihi havas shalom bein adam lachaveiro, bringing peace between parties. V'kachaya in yano shel Aharon oev shalom rodev shalom, etc. And that's what Aharon, Aaron, the high priest, used to do. He would pursue peace. So one motivation that's brought in Jewish law for promoting settlement is to encourage peace among parties. A second approach that's brought is a very interesting one. It's a little scary. Concern that if we were to apply the law, we would get it wrong. If we would apply the law, we get it wrong, so better to get them to compromise. It's sort of like when you go to the rabbi and you say, Rabbi, what's the status of the spoon? And you give him this whole long, detailed story about the history of the spoon that was in the food and out of the food, and it was hot, but it wasn't hot enough, and it was poured out. And the rabbi says, would you really mind just throwing it out? Would you mind just kashering it? No, your rabbi will not say that to you. I was a shul rabbi, and I said that, but your rabbi will not say that to you. But take a look at source number 15. Sorry, that joke didn't go over as well as it should have. But take a look at source number 15. Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Shulchan Aruch, 16th century Israel, says, Yesh koach ledayan lasos din ke'en hapshara. A judge may practice law in a manner of balancing, b'makom she'en hadavar yachol leisbarer, where the matter can't be clarified. He's not sure how to apply law to the given circumstance, So he can say to them, you know, it would be really good if you were to compromise on this instead. And then take a look at the following. This is fascinating to me anyway. Source number 16, another passage from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, concluding his section on pshara, on balancing. He writes, Tzrichim ha-dayanim li-hisrachek b'chol ha-yecholah shalo yikablu alayhem li-don din Torah. Justice, judges must distance themselves with all of their strength from accepting that they will judge by the law of Torah. They have to push compromise, he's saying, as hard as they can. Why? Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, the Vilna Gaon, writing at the end of the 18th century, said he goes back to a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, which is in source number 17. In the days of Shimon ben Shetach, so we're talking about early Common Era, in the days of Shimon ben Shetach, Nitlu Dine Mamun Ashei, actually, no, sorry, not early Common Era, a couple hundred years before that. The Nitlu Dine Mamonos, the Romans decreed that Jewish courts would not be allowed to handle financial cases. You wanted something adjudicated, you have to go to the Roman courts. That was their decree. Amar Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who is early Common Era, he says, Baruch Rachmana Delena Hakim Medon. He says, thank God they stopped us from handling these cases, because we're not wise enough to do it. Now, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is the wise of the wise in the Talmud. You don't get smarter, more learned than Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. But he's that afraid, and he says, you know, it's a really good thing. We can't judge these cases anymore because we'd get them wrong.
Yeah, it seems like there's a massive balancing act because who's to say that the Romans are going to get it right? But number two,
yeah.
You know, you could basically it's a balancing act. They're saying we're so afraid of going awry of Torah law, we'd rather have a big justice perpetrated by a secular, like under secular law,
yeah,
than we would potentially get it wrong under religious law.
Right. So I think it's important to note that he may not have been speaking literally. In other words, it's not as though the Romans went to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and asked him, should we take over? And his response was, yes, I'd like to have you take over. This is a reaction to a reality. At the same time, I think it does say something significant about reasons for promoting another system besides justice, because the Vilna Gaon looks at this and says, that's why the Code of Jewish Law says to promote compromise, because of a comment like this. So that's a second motivation. Yeah?
I mean, I think what I'm having trouble with is, you know, what we've been looking at until this very last source within the Jewish sources is this motivation towards peace, right? Towards promoting peace.
Yeah.
But the context that Matzei Din are dealing with and that the rabbis are addressing is very, very different than the context that our secular court system deals with, right? We don't have corporate personhood. We don't have global commerce, you know, where the parties before Beit Din really have no relationship. They're not in the same community. Like, you're not going to have that. In a secular court, you could be suing, you know, some global conglomerate that you, you know, in your one, like, it's a completely different context where peace doesn't really make as much sense. And so I'm not sure how much the value that we're seeing, the value of peace that we're seeing in the rabbinic discussions can be applied and translated to a modern secular legal construct where parties have no relationships.
But the answer is that you're right, that's a factor that has to be considered. Meaning, if my motivation is peace, then I have to ask, so where is this relevant and where is it not? I don't think it's a simple line of private versus corporate. It's more complicated than that. Right. No, I think it's still encouraged. I'm going to go a little bit ahead here just because, you know, we're accredited for 1.25 hours, so I feel comfortable with 1.25 hours. I don't want to hold people beyond, and there's still quite a bit to see. But the second element here is concern for applying justice inappropriately. The third concern is that justice is harsh. That really, you don't necessarily want justice. Right? To quote another courtroom, you can't handle the truth. If you take a look at source number 18, Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook applied this in a beautiful letter regarding justice. If you take a look there, he writes the following. Yasimna kvodo el libo, he says, his honor, the person to whom he's writing, should realize ki kol choku mishpat sheba olam lo yimalei la olam es kol hadrishos shakol hapratim. He says, no law or statute in the world is ever going to fulfill all the needs of every individual. And I'm going to shift into the English in the interest of time, but you can see his beautiful Hebrew here as well. Legislated laws, like natural laws, are general. They apply to the situation at large. And this is their glory and their strength. The sun emerges with its might. And if it will burn the head of some being, animal, or beast from time to time, this will not cause it to withhold its light and heat for the benefit of all. Right? Someone's going to suffer. It's the way it goes. We sweeten the bitterness of natural law, which sometimes overpowers us, not by removing it, which we cannot and would not do. You're not stopping the sun. But by creating artificial solutions, which enable us to benefit from their good. Right? Suntan lotion. So too, in a suitable way, we work when necessary and possible to enter into balancing of the desire of the litigants. This is especially so when justice is too harsh for one side, and certainly when it is too harsh for both sides. For this we say, the Torah says, tzedek, tzedek tirdo, justice, justice, you shall pursue. It says justice twice, once when it's law, and once when it's a compromise. That's the idea that he expresses. Sometimes the letter of the law is simply too harsh for the parties involved. And then we need to try to come up with some element of compromise that's going to that they can live with, that they can deal with. And that's a third approach. For, yeah.
It's not a concern that we're talking about an imposed judgment.
Yeah.
I understand it's very common. It's licensed for the Hasten to do whatever they want to do.
So I'm going to come back to that question. That's something I want to deal with a little further along. So remind me if I don't, but I know I will because it's in my notes. It's a very good question. The question is, so what does this mean? Does the court can do whatever it wants? What exactly are the rules that are going to govern this? So I'm going to come back to that. The fourth and last view for that I'm going to bring here and that I'm aware of for why Judaism opts for settlement in such a strong way is concern that controversy is going to continue. And I brought up one line in source number 20. The source number 19 is Rabbi Cook presenting another version of what he said in 18, but presenting it in a responsum of his. So I won't read it aloud, but you can see it there as well. Source number 20 is concerned that in the event that you apply a verdict, then the controversy is going to continue. Now, his case was not a financial case, although you can see it in financial cases. The case that's being dealt with in source number 20 by Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin is a case in which there were two groups in a synagogue, and one davened Nusach Sfard, and one davened Nusach Ashkenaz. One Ashkenaz style, and one Sfard style. And the question was, who's going to dictate which way the synagogue functions? So he says, you know, I could give you an answer that is the law, but it's not going to solve your problems. Yeah, that's the way they're going to solve their problems.
Yeah. That's because it was interest-based. It wasn't really law-based, right? So rights-based would be very different. There was a lease on the building, and which dictated how it, then you have to negotiate differently, but it was very interest-based.
I hear that. His statement is, if you can't use the law to bring about peace, whether because it's interest-based, or for any other reason, if it's not going to work, then you have to go with balancing simply because our goal is to have peace within society. I suppose this goes back to the social peace point in the first place. But what I want to bring you here is Rabbi Soloveitchik's formulation, which I alluded to much earlier. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik suggested that really the debate about whether to opt for settlement or not within Judaism is a debate about the definition of justice. He says, look back at what we saw in the passage from the Talmud that we brought in source number 9, and you will see that the second view we brought, the one that said it's a mitzvah to pursue compromise, quoted us two verses. one verse that promoted justice of peace, truth and justice of peace, and the other one that promoted justice and tzedakah. And he said those two have different goals. Take a look at what he writes in source number 21. This is a book by Rabbi Avram Beis Din called Reflections of the Rav. Rabbi Soloveitchik presented this in various instances, not only in this one, but this one I thought was a good summary. Yes, his last name is Beis Din. Yes, good name for a lawyer. Or a judge. In Pshara, however, he says, social harmony is the primary concern of the Dayan. The Dayan is the judge. The fine points of the law and the determination of precise facts are of secondary importance. The goal is not to be juridically astute, but to be socially healing. The first verse reads, "Execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates." Where there is strict adherence to din, to justice, to law, there is justice but no shalom, no peace. Because one of the parties is humiliated and antagonized. The immediate issue is resolved, but the conflict persists with ensuing social discord. And again, commercial may be different from individual. He should seek to persuade both parties to retreat from their presumed points of advantages. And he should preach to them about the corrosive personal and social effects of sustained rancor. His responsibility is primarily to enlighten rather than to render decisions on points of law. The first verse, therefore, projects the social welfare of society and the happiness of individuals as primary ideals, as being truly a higher form of justice. That's the first verse that's quoted. The second verse, though, is beyond that. It says that there is a form of justice that takes into consideration the needs of the parties, and that will bring about peace. And that's what he has in number 23. 22 also contributes to it, but I'm going to focus on 23, where Rabbi Beis Din continues, quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik. The second verse states, "And David executed justice and righteousness towards his people." This verse is concerned with the attainment of tzedek, tzedek meaning righteousness. In Aristotelian logic, there is a law of contradiction which states that a thesis and its antithesis, cannot both be valid. It follows from this logic that when two litigants present opposing claims, only one can be right. Strict logic demands the application of din, law, whereby the claim of the righteous party will be vindicated while the other party will be discredited. The halakha, the law, however, believes that absolute right and wrong can be realized only in heaven. In dealing with imperfect man, we posit that no man is totally right or wrong, and that in the case of the litigants, both are partially right and wrong. The application of din can only take account of obvious surface conditions. It fails to perceive subtleties underneath, which dilute our certainty about the right and the wrong of the litigants. Each has some responsibility for the situation. Don't tell this to your litigants. Don't tell this to your clients. Each has some responsibility for the situation and is partially guilty of the misunderstanding, for misleading innuendos, and for contributing indirectly to a climate in society which places others at a disadvantage. Strict justice deals with plain facts and salient reality. Real responsibility, however, goes much deeper and is obscured from the scrutiny of the court. Metaphysically, no one is entirely absolved, bless you, in situations of conflict. What Rabbi Soloveitchik contends is that true justice is broader than the letter of the law, and that's what you are applying when you go for compromise, is that you are attempting to satisfy not only the law, but something much broader than that, and your pshara, your compromise, is that way of arriving at that conclusion. Which brings me to the next point. I'm going to rush through some things and ask for questions to be held. But take a look at source number 24. Source number 24 adds to this idea. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik in a work called Nefesh HaRav, he says, "Our master," and he's talking about Rabbi Soloveitchik, his mentor, "would explain that balancing is also a legal verdict, but it is a verdict of transcending the line of the law based on justice. The law does not say to split the monetary sum in dispute in an attempt to compromise, but to establish based on a sense of justice who is right in this case." And he says sometimes the verdict of balancing will be 100% opposite what it would have been in law. It is acceptable, according to him, according to Rav Schachter, quoting Rav Soloveitchik, it is entirely acceptable to have a compromise which will be the reverse of what the verdict of law would have been. Tell that to your clients. People are accustomed to say, he says, that there are two kinds of balancing. There is balancing that is close to law, and there is general balancing. Our master, Rabbi Soloveitchik, said he did not understand this distinction. The entire matter of balancing is established by the verse, "You shall do that which is just and good." We are always obligated to act according to justice and transcending the line of the law, and if so, this itself is the Torah's law. That's his argument, is that compromise is, in fact, what the Torah wants you to do under a principle known in Hebrew as lifnim mishurat hadin, going beyond the letter of the law. Now, he said something here which is controversial. Well, he said a few things, but one in particular, he said, your compromise may be 100% opposite what the verdict would have been in court. So that goes back to your question of, so what are the rules that govern how you do this? So here I quote you opposing views. Source number 25. Rabbi David ben Shalom ibn Avi Zimrod, also known as Radbaz, who dealt with a particular case, and I'm not going to get into the specifics of the case right now, but he disqualified the compromise because he felt it was too far from the actual law. If you flip the page for source number 26, the Shmut Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, he's the one who says to look at pshara as poshrin, something lukewarm, balancing the sides, neither cold nor hot. He said, I don't have a precise threshold for what exactly is the limit for compromise, but he believes it should be that the guilty party ends up paying at least two-thirds of what he would have had to pay under the letter of the law. That's his definition. At least two-thirds, and he has a basis for this that he goes into. But the point is that you have a difference of opinion here. You have some who are saying that compromise still has to be governed by the same principles that govern law, just with more leeway to satisfy the sides. And then you have another approach that says no. Compromise, this is Rabbi Shafter speaking about Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. He says no, compromise is a different animal. It takes into account broader considerations, and your conclusion may not reflect at all the position of the law. I think this disagreement is fundamentally about how I view compromise. Is compromise a legal proceeding, or is compromise really its own animal and not to be compared to a legal proceeding? And that may explain something very interesting in sources 27 and 28. Source 27 is one commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. Source number 28 is another commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. But they take different views about how you promote compromise. According to source 27, the judge is not supposed to push compromise. Just mention that it exists as an option. Source number 28, the Sma commentary to Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, disagrees and says no. He has to try to persuade them, to encourage them, to convince them that this is what they really want. How can you have two different views like this? Because within Judaism you have two different views of what's going on when you compromise. In secular law, in Ontario, we have a very clear understanding of what compromise is. It's not law. It is outside of the law. It is a pragmatic means of, as was said before, streamlining dockets. It's a way to make things smoother. It's a way to save people money. And it doesn't matter whether you arrive at your conclusion by applying the principles of law or whether you have them stand on their heads and see who can stand on their head longer, and that's the one who wins. As long as both sides... Well, it's not entirely true. I'm not being fair. I strike that one. The truth is that there is an expectation that reasonable, rational principles will be used, and there are, in fact, rules governing what you can do. But it's much more up to the parties to decide how it's going to happen. In Jewish law, what we're seeing here is compromise is promoted, whether because we don't know what we're doing in terms of applying law, or whether because we want to find peace, whichever motivation we're going to provide for it. But there's a fundamental debate as to whether it's supposed to function like law, or whether it's free to be freewheeling and to do as it chooses. The last point: the different logical reasons for compromise, the pragmatic in Ontario, versus the ideological within Judaism, influence the structure of how we pursue this compromise. In Ontario, we say, any system that will allow them to come to a solution that satisfies them enough to stay out of the courts is sufficient. And even though it's true there are certain rules, there aren't many rules for it. If you go to the website of the Attorney General, they list all sorts of options, but more than that, there are options beyond arbitration and beyond mediation. They have now social justice tribunals, which handle everything from landlord-tenant disputes to family issues. You have a call that was just actually produced on March 3rd. There was a call for public consultation by the Ministry for the Attorney General's Office for administrative monetary penalties for traffic offenses in order to reduce the backlog in traffic courts. They're trying to come up with any and all means possible to clear the dockets and ensure that people have a speedy resolution to their conflicts. There are aspects of Jewish law that seem to reflect an Ontario-like approach, such as the view that says that compromise may be done by just one judge. You don't need a full three-judge panel like a court. That sounds like it's not really a practice of justice. The idea that we require kinyan, they have to perform this act that says we are going to abide by the decree, because the decree doesn't have the force of a judicial verdict. The fact that we offer the litigants the chance to approve the proposal, this makes it sound like it's really not justice, it's some other animal. On the other hand, you have Rabbi Soloveitchik's assertion, as reported by his student, Rabbi Shachter, that the nuances of how pshara, of how compromise is practiced, demonstrate that this actually is a form of justice. Because you have laws like, as I brought in number 29, the judge is warned not to warp justice in court and not to warp justice when he's doing compromise, when he's arranging compromises either. The rule is that a judge in a Jewish court is not allowed to be paid. There are certain ways in which they arrange for having people who will still judge, but the judge is not allowed to be paid. The same thing is true for a mediator, the mediator, the judge who's functioning in this capacity, is not allowed to take payment either. The fact that we use the judge to promote it, all of these things make it seem like it is a function of justice. So the upshot and the summary of what we're saying is the following. Number one, both Ontario and Jewish tradition are strongly in favor of promoting settlement, although with internal debate about whether that's really the best approach. Ontario's approach tends towards the pragmatic. The Jewish approach mentions the pragmatic in terms of concern that we're going to apply law wrong, that kind of an approach, but also the ideological. The pragmatic approach plays out in a more participatory style, in which the litigants themselves get to choose how it's going to happen and whether they're going to accept the agreement and so on. Whereas the approach that says, no, this is a function of law, that ideologically law includes this sort of compromise, that approach says that the litigants don't get to choose, and it's the judge who's going to impose it, and the litigants are going to be responsible to accept it. Practical application, possibly, if someone has an observant Jewish client, would be twofold. Number one, encouraging settlement for the client, not only because of his personal best interest, which I think is the normal approach, but also because of society's best interest, and saying, well, look, we also believe in promoting peace between people and in society, and on that basis, you might want to pursue settlement. That's number one. But number two, recognizing that both arbitration and mediation have sources within the system of Jewish law, and it's not some outside thing, but it actually has sources within our tradition. I apologize for racing through the last 20 minutes. I would have much preferred to do it as a discussion, but I spent a lot of time in the beginning on some of the technical issues. But please, questions. I am glad to have questions. I just want to make sure that people who leave sign in so that we know that you were here in terms of your credit, and so that I can follow up with on any items from the class itself. There's a sign-in sheet here. There is another sign-in sheet. Where was the other one? The other one is right here, and you can always write on the back if there isn't any room on the front. Questions? Yechiel.
as a family law lawyer, I now feel very good. Thank you very much for that talk and integrating the two systems correctly, because I know under the family law rules, mediative techniques are embedded in the system. Shara is a goal of the family law system in Ontario. And so as I'm doing my work, I can think the Ralph Soloveitchik is smiling down on me. And Mr. Ben Moore, Mr. Bach, and others, the Swedish practice men.
Okay. Good. Yes, Jeffrey.
So if you're talking about alternatives to the standard court system, what ultimately would dictate whether we should support or oppose the adoption in Ontario, for example, of Sharia law or other alternatives? Sorry, it's a contentious question, but it works for them. If it's all of what you want, mediation, arbitration, and the faith-based system, should we as
it's a really interesting question. It requires more thought than the seconds that I had while you were speaking. But a couple of general thoughts. Number one, I think that to a certain extent, the Jewish community has been damaged in terms of its rights by movements of law that were meant to prevent Sharia law from taking hold. The obvious case is family law. The fact that Jewish courts are not able to hear family law cases and issue verdicts that will be binding on participants is, as I understand it, a result of laws that were created because of Sharia law, because they didn't want Muslim families having their cases handled by Sharia law. So the result of that is, among other things, a weakening of Jewish courts in the cases of Aguna. So I think that's worth thinking about. The hand that strikes one also strikes the other. So that's one piece. The greater question, I think, is a very interesting one, is, you know, what concern do we have for the good of society in the event that you balkanize law and everyone has their own systems?
Like the natives.
But on the other hand, if we're going to argue, I know nothing about the natives and their system of law. The question is it fair for us to expect that we should be able to have it and not say that some other religious group should be able to apply theirs? I don't think that's particularly fair. As a general rule, I'm a believer in the idea that the less we expect the law to accommodate our unique needs and conform to our unique system, the better off we will be. What we really want to promote is a legal system in which people, including us, are free to do that which they choose, so long as, with a major proviso, that it's not going to harm others. So that I would rather see a legal system that will allow everybody to have their system, if that's going to allow me to do mine, as opposed to a system which says, no one gets their own, including you Jews. I think that it's healthier that way. But again, that's just a first thought in response to your question. I think it requires better analysis.
Can I correct something there?
Yeah.
Rev. Kirchner is certainly correct that the lessening the, well, actually eliminating the base deen in family law arbitrations as a result of the earlier trend that Muslims want Sharia law. So legislation was passed to prevent that. But I don't believe that the legislation weakens the base deen when it comes to the situation of Gunnar, because thanks to John Cash's effort, the legislation passed in the federal parliament and the federal legislature, we do have legislative provisions that enable us to use the civil courts and the base deen.
So the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes, you're right, that the Gett Law, as it's called, made major advances, but there are two problems. Problem number one is that's provincial. It doesn't go beyond Ontario, I believe. I don't believe it's federal. It is federal? Okay, then my first one is wrong, but my second one I know is right. The way the Gett Law works is, and John explained it to me, so I have a pretty good authority. The way the Gett Law works is that it says that the father is not going to be able to make any filings in court so long as he has not agreed to the religious divorce. And since, even to defend himself against, let's say, a custody claim, he's going to need to make a filing, his hands are then tied. However, in a case in which there are no children, and the father doesn't have any money to be claimed, he doesn't need to make any filings, and therefore he can hang on as long as he likes. And in fact, I know of cases like that. In the event that the Jewish courts were able to function, you could do what, let's say, the Rabbinical Council of America has done in the United States, which is they have a prenuptial agreement, which many rabbis accept. There are those who are uncomfortable with it, but the point is that the prenuptial agreement says in it that the sides agree that in the event that they stop living together, they will go to, and it names a rabbinical court, to deal with the problem and to handle the divorce and so on. But because in Ontario, you're not able to go to this rabbinical court, they're not empowered to arbitrate, that has no teeth. So that prenuptial agreement is what doesn't work, and that's because of the rule against Sharia law catching us in the net as well.
It's better that we have death legislation or not.
Someone's not happy with that. Yeah.
The exception is, as you pointed out, where one of the, I won't kind of put it in gender terms, but when one of the spouses has no skin in the game, no money to give,
right.
No money to lose, so they don't care what happens in the second report. That's
right.
True. Most cases aren't like that.
Yeah, no, it's a very good advance. It's just not everything.
If you use the legislation properly, consultation with the local Orthodox rabbi, preferably with the Beis Din, then it can be very effective.
And I'm not going to go further with this because it's not sort of the issue at hand. I'll take questions first regarding the actual topic, and then we can have fun discussions about other things. Michael has been waiting.
Justice and settlement is supposed to be justice. In certain instances, it's true. Either a judge or a rabbi don't have enough information in front of them. It's a case of he said, she said, it's a case of credibility. It's difficult. And if I was their position, I would certainly sympathize that if one rabbi's guy settled it, because I'm going to settle it, and I don't have enough information there, except that you guys are telling me. But it's very often the case where one party is taking advantage of the system. We're taking advantage of the fact that settlements are mandatory, and they know that nothing could lose everything again. What about the idea of undermining the law or undermining halacha and bringing halacha into dispute?
Right.
If somebody does the wrong thing and comes out, with a lot of the law that he deserves to get, because
Right. So I think ultimately, because the sources put this at the discretion of the judge is able to say, in this case, I don't think that I should be promoting this. I think that in this case, it's going to lead to somebody taking advantage. The judge has to be smart and has to be perceptive. But I think that's true. I think you will have cases in which it's inappropriate. And that goes back to the point that was made in the beginning, that there's a difference between commercial cases and private cases. There's a difference between where this is something that is a commercial dispute that each case is going to be different. And well, what he's suggesting there is that this is a brand of law which will be broader than the narrow application of the books, that as such, it may actually be a truer application of justice, but he's still not going to say, and this is what you do in every case. And not only that, because he is so free in terms of how it can be done, he's actually giving the judge the right to say, I'm going to reopen everything and analyze everything, and decide who should get what based on how I see fit, in which case the fellow who's trying to take advantage of the system is going to find himself getting burned by the compromise he thought he was getting. Because he may be on the zero side of the 100-0. That can happen within this system. Jeffrey.
I think Rabbi Kuck and also Rabbi Kuck are saying something even a bit more. Because we're basically talking about parties and compromise. They seem to, the undertones in what they're saying compromise within the law itself. They're almost like you're talking about the laws of equity that we developed over the years.
Why, where do you see that in Rabbi Cook? Right.
That's how we got the courts of equity to reckon.
Yes, no, that is so. But they're... But what they're doing is not to write a new legal system for those cases where our current laws don't meet out what we're considering to be justice. What they're doing is saying that's what we have trained judges for, and we're going to look to our judge, who is an expert in halakha, and ask him to... Right. Right. I hear that. I hear that. Yes.
Is there any other explanation for that comment? Because otherwise I'm baffled by it. The idea that a just compromise would be 100% different from what the law says.
No, I think that is the explanation. That to me is what explains it. Yes, and then yes.
Why an announcement?
An announcement.
Mondays from now, 2 weeks, March 30 and 7 at 6 o'clock in Carlton, is a viewing of the trial of Vivian Ansel, which is the Israeli film.
Yes.
On Agunot. That's 2 weeks from 10 to 6. My question is, this notion of settlement stems from the concept of justice, which in Hebrew is Dachau, which is simply another word in English for righteousness, which has the word right in it. Which is wrong, which therefore brings back to the notion there is right and wrong. Settlement, on the other hand, invokes the concept of compromise, sacrifice, concession. Doesn't the notion of engaging in the discussion of compromise, concession, and settlement distance ourselves as a society from the concept of right and wrong, and then allow society at large use the very rule of law as being something that is forever bendable in the interest of achieving one's own gain? Because we could eventually always find reason to shed gray over black and white,
right,
in the interest of putting ourselves away from right and wrong.
Right. So my answer to that would be that it depends on which vision you have of compromise. If your vision of compromise is this is a pragmatic thing, meant to make life easier for society and for the litigants, then yes, it's a statement that there's a price on justice and we're not willing to pay that price. If, however, you say, as Rav Schaffner expects within Rav Soloveitchik, that the justice that is meted out by the law is narrow in its considerations and isn't equipped to look at the broader issues that are relevant in each individual case, and compromise is a means of doing that, where the judges are going to look more broadly, then, if anything, is actually a broader and greater pursuit of justice than that which the law provides. It dishonors the law, because it says the law is inadequate, but it absolutely honors justice. And then, there was a hand over here. That's true, and that's something that we see in the case law, where also true. I mean, there's a great paper that was written by Rabbi Michael Broyd, which I didn't bring here just because there was too much material as it was. But he has a great paper that sort of takes everything I've done is sort of before the paper begins. And his question is, so how do we create a system of alternative dispute resolution within Jewish courts that will be honored by secular society? And he talks about it in the context of what courts in the U.S. have done and rabbinical courts have done in terms of measures like having very clearly defined principles and procedures, in terms of having a system of appeal and the possibility of reversal, doing things that show that what you're doing is reasonable, that what you're doing fits our conception of how orderly law is administered, is a step towards that kind of recognition in the secular system. Yeah.
In the next session, you have to talk about the state versus an individual. What you sue or what you compromise against the state.
Got it. Well, maybe at some point. I did a whole bunch of more researches. I learned all about Mary Carter agreements. Like, there's a whole lot of law up here now that's going to disappear in about 24 hours. But no, the next session, actually, I don't remember when it is. It's sometime in May, I believe. We'll be at the Bayit on a Sunday morning at 8:45. I think it's May 10th, but I'm not sure of that. But our topic is conflicts of interest and defining conflicts of interest within Ontario law and within Jewish law.
Robbie, don't you have a program on Wednesday afternoon? I saw 5,000.
Oh, yeah, I have a lunch and learn. That's not CPD accredited, but yeah, it's a lunch and learn at Miller Bernstein. I think it's 5000 Yonge Street. And the topic is Jew versus Jew in secular court and the issue of litigating in secular court. If anyone is interested, you can email me and I'll give you the information about it. My email address is on the source sheets. I think. Have a good night.
Yeah. This is